Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is the 1A Podcast. I'm Jen White and you're listening to the News Roundup. Two huge court cases with implications for the whole country are underway in Georgia and Wisconsin. We'll check in on both. Plus, Boosters for All is back on the table. And GOP Representative Paul Gosar is censured by Congress, but endorsed for re-election by former President Trump. We'll also have the latest on the Build Back Better plan, which just passed in the House. It moves now to the Senate. Let's get to it. David Lightman is the congressional correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. He joins me in studio. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Zeleny is the chief national affairs correspondent with CNN. Jeff, great to have you.
Thank you.
So the jury is still out in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse. Last year, Rittenhouse shot three people, killing two during protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Jeff, this case has come under a ton of scrutiny for everything from the role of the judge to the unorthodox jury selection process. Walk us through some of the ways in which this case is unusual.
Well, it's unusual in so many ways. I mean, one of the ways has just been how it's played out in front of us, ending just a couple days ago when the defendant himself was allowed to essentially reach into a, you know, what looked like a bingo game device to pick members of the jury. So something we just don't see a lot in these cases. But the, you know, it was very unusual that the defendant took the stand in his own defense and really gave his side of the story. But the judge certainly has been a very lively character in this. But going forward, the jury, as they deliberate on Friday, entering really into their fourth day, I believe, of deliberation. So all eyes, of course, will be on Kenosha to see what those jurors do. It seems that they're really struggling here. They're really struggling to find a verdict, perhaps find consensus. We really don't know what's going on behind closed doors. But on Thursday evening, the judge allowed the jurors to take home the jury questionnaire. It's a very complex set of instructions that they're sort of dealing with. So it's perhaps not surprising that it is has taken as long as it has. But certainly all eyes will be on Kenosha for, you know, what could be the fallout of this. But my colleagues I've been talking to on the ground there, you know, really say that they do not expect the city to sort of explode in a divisive action after this. There's been just a small crowd of people outside the courthouse. So certainly, hopefully, that remains true.
Well, meanwhile, the defense has rested its case in the trial of the McMichaels and William Bryan Jr. Last year, the three men chased, shot, and killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. David, what did we learn from the defense in this case?
Well, excuse me, that McMichael, who took the stand yesterday, I guess, says he was acting in self-defense. When the prosecutor questioned him and asked, did you ever have time to say he would tell him he was under arrest, he said no. He claimed that the shotgun in question was pulled from him. There are a lot of the defense says that he felt threatened, but there was never any overt evidence of a threat. This is going to be a tough one, I think, for the jury. McMichael, though, answered the questions in a sober fashion. He was respectful. We'll see.
Jeff, closing arguments are set to begin on Monday. What are you watching for?
Certainly just, how all this is reconciled, these three separate defendants. Will the attorneys try and separate, really try and make the case for each one individually? One of the issues here is, there really was not an uptick in crime in the neighborhood. That was one of the things that we heard at the time during this. And the prosecution simply pointed out that that wasn't the case at all. So the makeup of the jury also so interesting there. Is not representative of the community. It seems that we'll just have to keep our eye on it and see, but certainly a complicated case as well.
And that jury makeup in Georgia, 11 white jurors, one black juror. In another court case, an update to a case from more than 50 years ago, two men convicted of killing civil rights leader Malcolm X have now been exonerated after spending decades in prison. A two-year investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney found that evidence of their innocence was withheld at trial. The DA apologized in a court hearing on Thursday.
I apologize on behalf of our nation's law enforcement for this decades-long injustice, which has eroded public faith in institutions that are designed to guarantee equal protection of the law.
Both men were released from prison in the 1980s and spent the rest of their lives trying to clear their names. One has since died. The other is now in his early 80s. We're rounding up the week's news with David Lightman, the congressional correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Jeff Zeleny, chief national affairs correspondent with CNN. We also want to hear from you. What stories caught your eye this week? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Well, this morning, the House of Representatives voted to pass President Biden's social infrastructure plan called the Build Back Better plan. Now it'll move to the Senate, where it's expected to hit some major obstacles. This all came despite House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy's best efforts to delay a vote.
This is a tipping point. This is a point of not coming back from. The American people have spoken, but unfortunately, Madam Speaker, the Democrats have not listened.
That's part of an 8.5-hour speech McCarthy gave on the House floor late last night. David, remind us what's in this plan.
Okay, $1.75 trillion, money to promote to expedite climate change. There's tax increases for the wealthy. There is child tax credits expanded for 1 year, pre-kindergarten 6 years, child care help. It's quite a social service bill. The thing to remember, though, about this bill is that it passed the House, and there are going to be big changes in the Senate if it ever gets through the Senate. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, when the Senate returns, and they're going to be off for this next week for Thanksgiving, they still have to contend with government funding that runs out December 3rd, a debt limit that will probably be hit December 15th, and then they're going to break for Christmas. I suspect we'll be talking about this on this show come springtime.
And how long does this – what period of time does this bill encompass? Because it's not a one-year bill.
No. In fact, it depends on – basically, they budgeted for 10 years. But, again, there are different programs. And this is part of the controversy. In fact, this is a story I want to develop. A lot of things expire. Child tax credit expansion is only 1 year, 2022. Pre-K funding, 6 years. Earned income tax credit, I believe, also expanded for 1 year and so on. Now, they do this for a lot of reasons. One is budgetary. It looks less costly. And the hope is that, well, if you do it for 1 year, people will like it so much that the clamor will be such you just have to renew it. That theory was just terrific and has been for 40, 50 years. I'm not so sure it's going to hold anymore, given the bitterness and the polarization in Congress.
Well, we got this tweet from A.C. Monroe, who says, it's a shame that Manchin and Sinema have gutted almost all the most important policies from Build Back Better, and they're not done yet. I can't even imagine how neutered the final bill will be when and if it passes the Senate and gets to the president's desk. Jeff, explain a little bit more about what's at play in the Democratic Party around this bill right now.
Well, look, this certainly has been divisive inside the Democratic Party. This was the second part of the president's really sweeping economic agenda. We saw the infrastructure bill was finally passed after about 3 months of fighting. The president signed that into law, but this is part two. And as David was just explaining there, it really is a sweeping set of social programs. But the price tag has been a sticking point, and it certainly will be, as well as some of the other issues in the Senate. So it is very much an open question if this will pass the Senate or not. And for all the frustration out there among some liberals and Democrats about Senator Joe Manchin or Senator Kyrsten Sinema, if they weren't there, this wouldn't even be a discussion. Joe Manchin is, an important senator. Some of his fellow senators call him Mr. President, but he's the 50th Democratic vote, so they need this. So what he is going to do, he's had many conversations with the White House, with the president, and in the end, White House officials I talked to, and the president believes that Joe Manchin will be there for him in the end with a scaled-down program. But that is the question. How scaled will it be? But time is of the essence here. This is likely the last piece of legislation that that this White House and this Congress will work on in a big way. Next year's an election year, and Democratic prospects for holding their majorities are pretty slim if history is a good judge here. So this is kind of the last shot.
We'll be back with more in the moment. And remember to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app, and leave us a voicemail.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, BetterHelp, the online counseling service dedicated to connecting you with a licensed counselor to help you overcome whatever stands in the way of your happiness. Fill out a questionnaire and get matched with a professional tailored to your needs. And if you aren't satisfied with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time, free of charge. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to get 10% off your first month. Get the help you deserve with BetterHelp.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're rounding up some of the week's biggest headlines. Let's get back to the conversation. Bill emailed, say something about the $80,000 salt cap, a big tax cut for the wealthy. And I think you alluded to this a little earlier, David, but explain a little bit more.
Boy, this is one that's tearing the Democratic Party apart. The 2017 tax law, which was authored by Republicans, capped the salt deduction, state and local tax deduction, at $10,000. It had been unlimited. Democrats ever since have tried and tried, and frankly, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, who are both from high-tax states, have supported this. The House raised the cap to $80,000. The Tax Policy Center, the Tax Foundation, all the independent analysts show the same thing, that the wealthy benefit the most from this. What do you do here? The Senate, Senators Menendez and Sanders, have an alternative that would cap this at roughly $400,000 to $550,000. They're still working out the details. But still, that's a tax break for people with high or middle six-figure incomes. On the one hand, New York, New Jersey, California, the high-tax state, that's crucial to the Democratic base. On the other hand, by doing this, as Chuck Grassley, the Republican senator from Iowa, says, aren't you doing exactly what you said you weren't going to do, help the wealthy? This is a very tough issue for Democrats.
Mark has this question via Twitter. Can Republicans simply stop the spending on the infrastructure bill when, or we should say if, they take control in 2023? Jeff, your thoughts?
I'm not so sure that they would want to. I mean, for all the hand-wringing and the, you know, the finger-pointing from really led by former President Donald Trump from the outside, he's encouraging action to be taken against these 13 House members who voted for infrastructure. But don't forget there were 19 Republican senators who also voted for the bill, including Mitch McConnell and others. So by and large, this funding is going to be in the pipeline and largely out the door, at least a good portion of it. So I'm not so sure that Republican mayors out there, county officials and others, are going to want to stop spending on infrastructure, at least. And say the Build Back Better, this part two of the agenda gets passed. Again, very difficult for – you can change laws, of course, but stopping funding for something that is already in the pipeline is difficult.
Well, this week, the Biden administration kicked off a nationwide tour aimed at showcasing the benefits of its newly signed infrastructure bill. Here's President Biden at the first stop, a decaying bridge in New Hampshire.
Thanks to the infrastructure law, we're going to make the most significant investment to modernize our roads and our bridges in 70 years. Law is going to speed up replacement of bridges by at least a year and allow New Hampshire to invest in other critical infrastructure needs. Thanks to the congressional delegation, this law also represents the most significant investment in passenger rail in 50 years in public transit ever. Here in New Hampshire, that means replacing about one-third of the transit vehicles, buses and the like, that are past their useful life.
Now, Jeff, we know that a lot of the projects covered in the infrastructure deal are years away from completion. But what will you be watching for as the Biden administration touts this win?
I think overall, just watching for the competence in implementing these plans. This is really a lot of money we're talking about, and it is very complicated. So I was actually out in Michigan last week talking with a lot of Republican mayors and a Democratic member of Congress, Alyssa Slotkin, who voted for this, but she's in a Trump district. And she, I think, makes a very good point in saying this is now just the beginning of the road for infrastructure, not the end of the road. And by that, it means implementation. So this money has to go to the states, and then some of the state legislatures are split in terms of parties and other things. So implementing these programs, implementing these projects is going to take considerable amount of work. So it will test the competence of government. And, you know, it's an open question how well this will work. But that, of course, is one of the reasons the White House brought Mitch Landrieu from New Orleans, Louisiana, of course, on to administer all of this. But it will test if government can work and the competence of this administration.
David, your thoughts?
Yeah, historically, massive infrastructure legislation does not elect presidents or defeat them. You go back to 2009 when the Obama administration got a major stimulus bill passed, and I remember they had a list of shovel-ready projects, and of course, the next year, 2010, Democrats got clobbered in the midterm elections, and infrastructure really wasn't an issue. What I've found over the years is that, first of all, people expect the roads to be built. It's not like they're getting – the child tax credit, for example, is different. That's – hey, that's a great benefit. But infrastructure, this is what they expect government to do. The second thing is this. I found anecdotally that people don't think of the federal government when they think of roads. In other words, if there's a pothole on your street, you don't call the U.S. Department of Transportation. Or if the high – there's a traffic jam on your highway, you don't think, darn, that Pete Buttigieg, you know. Hmm. No, you think of local people. You think of your local councilman. So I'm skeptical that this is going to be any political benefit.
Well, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has extended the debt ceiling deadline to December 15th. That gives Congress almost two extra weeks to avoid the first default in U.S. history. On 1A earlier this week, Secretary Yellen told us she would support scrapping the debt ceiling altogether.
This isn't a position that President Biden has articulated, but I personally feel that would be a desirable thing to do. What the debt ceiling does is to impose an arbitrary time when it becomes impossible to finance plans and deficits that have been decided by past Congresses. The debt ceiling isn't about future decisions about spending or taxing. It's about paying the bills that have been amassed because of decisions of previous Congresses and administrations.
Secretary Yellen also talked about the impact of continuing to bump up against that deadline and what would happen if we actually pass it. You can find the full conversation online at the 1A.org. Now, David, you've been following the fiscal situation in Congress between the prospects for Build Back Better and the new debt ceiling deadline. What needs to happen before this new deadline?
Well, first big deadline is December 3rd when the government, in theory, runs out of money. That doesn't mean that the military is going to stand down, but the government wouldn't have money. The talk is that what they'll do is kick the can further down the road, maybe extend funding 2 weeks or maybe into March. But you could argue politically this is why people hate Congress. You know, they're supposed to have this wrapped up September 30, and they never do. The debt ceiling's a different matter because that's really playing with fire. If this government defaults, which has never happened, not only does it throw the U.S. economy into turmoil, but the world economy. And Yellen has been Secretary Yellen has been saying this for months. In fact, there was a hearing, I think, in September during the first debt ceiling crisis where she said, make this thing permanent. That's not going to happen. Because the lawmakers want to be able to say, look, I don't vote for runaway spending. I put a cap on how much can be spent, even though, you know, we know that they're just going to extend it again, Republican and Democrat. So this is predictable, this is unfortunate, but I'm afraid December is going to be consumed by this.
Well, Jeff, what does it mean for our economy that there is this constant instability, even if the expectation is that Congress will at some point extend the debt ceiling once again? Continuing to bump up against this deadline has an impact.
It does have an impact. And I think one of the impacts is this just a psychological impact. We talk a lot about inflation, which, of course, is very real, high gas prices, high cost of groceries and other things. But there's also a record amount of spending. A lot of people are buying goods. But I think psychologically, always running up against these deadlines. And we're about to see something conflated here. As David was talking about, the month of December is going to be consumed with talk of the debt ceiling. Republicans will continue to use that as an argument to vote against the Biden agenda, which, of course, that has nothing to do with it. This is previous spending. This is spending from previous lawmakers, previous legislation, the Trump administration, tax cuts, all the rest. So what it does is it just simply muddies the waters here, but I think contributes to the sort of psychological sense that the economy is perhaps in worse shape than it actually is. But I think Secretary Yellen has a lot of support in terms of eliminating the debt ceiling. It will never happen because members of Congress will not vote to take this away because it will be, you know, potentially used against them in campaigns and things. So it is here to stay, I'm afraid.
Well, one more piece of congressional news. The House voted to censure GOP Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona on Wednesday. The vote comes after Gosar posted an edited anime video to his social media account. It depicted violence against Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and President Joe Biden. Gosar defended his actions during the hearing.
I rise today to address and reject the mischaracterization, accusations from many in this body that the cartoon from my office is dangerous or threatening. It was not.
Congresswoman Cortez had a different message for the GOP.
It is a sad day in which a member who leads a political party in the United States of America cannot bring themselves to say that issuing a depiction of murdering a member of Congress is wrong.
The last time a member of the chamber was censured was more than a decade ago. We got this email from Janice who says, I find it shocking that Gosar's actions were not universally censured. If any of my grandchildren did in school what he did in Congress, my grands would be expelled. But Gosar's colleagues just nodded and winked. David, what does it mean to be censured? What are the consequences?
Well, other than expulsion, it's the worst rebuke that you can get from your colleagues. It basically says your colleagues highly disapprove of this. You stand in the well of the House. You're told what you did wrong. Now, what's interesting here, and this is what's fascinating about this, is that when Gosar stood in the well, he had about a dozen members stand with him, Republicans. Republicans pretty much, I think two Republicans, Cheney and Kinzinger, voted with the Democrats on this. The polarization here is highly unusual. I mean, I've seen these censures now for 40 years. Nothing like this. And I may be wrong about this, so correct me, but I don't think he's apologized yet to Ocasio-Cortez for what he did, which is, again, the polarization, the bitterness, the bile – I know we talk about this, but I've just never seen anything like this.
You know, Jeff, as David says, the vote to censure Gosar went mostly down party lines, with the exception of Republicans Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger joining Democrats. Meanwhile, former President Trump endorsed Gosar for re-election shortly after the vote happened. What do you think it means that the GOP's response to his actions, what does it mean for the increasing acceptance of calls to violence?
It just means that, the rules of decorum, the rules of basic decency have essentially evaporated from the lower chamber of Congress. I mean, the acrimony, as David is saying, is right on. It's just so intense, and it bleeds over into absolutely everything. There were a lot of Republicans, a lot more Republicans, who called out this behavior and said that it was not appropriate, but they did not join in the censure vote, largely because they are afraid of their own bases. Now, I think the biggest thing also, it strips him of his committee assignments. And there were some Republican members who said, look, the Ethics Committee should handle this, so this should go through the appropriate channels. But look, overall, writ large, it's just one more example of the absolute acrimony, really, in this divisive time we're living in. And the House is just utterly, utterly divided because of this.
Go ahead, David.
Oh, I was going to say, what's – I don't know if scary is the word, but, you know, having covered Congress for some 40 years – it was always a place you enjoyed covering because there are people everywhere, people to talk to, tourists, and so forth. If you walked in there today, there are metal detectors before you go into the chamber, and there's a metal detector before you even go into the press room. I mean, it's a strange feeling. You can still talk to people in the halls, but not the way you could. And the halls are empty because there are no tourists. The whole atmosphere over on the House side, the Senate's a little looser. There are no metal detectors to get into the press areas. But boy, it's strange.
Well, let's move on to the investigation into the January 6th insurrection. Longtime ally to former President Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, turned himself into the FBI Monday morning following his indictment on contempt of Congress charges. Federal prosecutors and Bannon's defense attorneys are already in a battle over how quickly the criminal case should move. Jeff, walk us through exactly what led to Bannon's surrender to the FBI.
One of the things that led to it is, he simply is, Steve Bannon, of course, is just being defiant here. He said he's taking his marching orders, if you will, from the former president and believe that he should not have to cooperate. Never mind that he was not working in the White House at the time. He had, you know, been absent from the Trump administration, gone from the Trump administration for about 3 years or so. But he is using this as a chance to make a political point. He, you know, when he was surrendering, he said, we are going to bring down the Biden regime. So he simply now, his lawyers this week have essentially asked to slow walk this case. Most defendants, most accused want their swift and speedy proceeding. He does not want that. He wants to slow it down. But what it does, it potentially has the consequence of making a mockery of the whole January 6th commission, spreading it out, lengthening it. But there will be some of the former Trump advisors who likely do not have the money or the fame or the stomach for this, as Steve Bannon does, and some may cooperate. I mean, of course, we'll see what Mark Meadows, a former member of the House, he is also not cooperating but has not yet been arrested, of course. So it just, once again, it muddies this entire process, and it makes the work of the January 6th the commission all that much more difficult when it really is devolved into a sideshow with the addition of Steve Bannon's antics.
And we should mention here that Steve Bannon is refusing to testify before Congress, claiming he's covered by executive privilege. David, how important is this investigation into what happened that day?
I think there's two ways to look at this. One is the legal process. The other is the political process. And the legal process, as Jeff was saying, is going to be slow. And there's going to be talk about executive privilege. And apparently Chairman Benny Thompson of the January 6th committee is talking about recommending criminal contempt charges against Mark Meadows. So, yes, that'll be slow. But look at the political side of this. The committee wants to call, I think, roughly 36 witnesses. That's going to be heavily covered. And so you're going to have this drip, drip, drip of information that could go months, go right up to the November election and beyond. So there you go. There's your political turmoil.
We're here with David Lightman of McClatchy Newspapers and CNN's Jeff Zeleny. We're rounding up this week's news. And up next, we'll talk about COVID. Booster shots could be on the table for all adults. I'm Jen White. More from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. When it comes to match three style puzzle games, only one reigns supreme, Best Fiends. It's an action-packed adventure game and puzzle game rolled into one, so it's no wonder it's got so many five-star reviews. Plus, there's new content added all the time. If you're tired of crushing the same old candy, give Best Fiends a try. You can download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play Store. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Let's bring one more voice into the conversation. Apoorva Mundavilli covers science and global health for the New York Times. Apoorva, always great to have you on.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So let's jump in here with COVID and boosters. This morning, the FDA authorized Pfizer and Moderna booster shots for all adults. The move still must be approved by the CDC. So talk us through what happens now, Apoorva.
Well, the CDC advisors are going to meet today from 12 to 3, and then they will vote on whether this is a good idea. And then the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, will probably sign off on it. I'm not really expecting any surprises from this afternoon's conversation. I think the CDC advisors will basically say, yes, go ahead. Everybody should get a booster. What's interesting about this, though, is that this conversation has been changing continuously for weeks. And a lot of the experts I've been talking to, including a lot of these advisors to the FDA and CDC, don't actually think boosters are necessary for people under 65. So it's just a little bit confusing and fast-paced and puzzling, really, that we are going ahead full blast with these boosters.
Well, we got this tweet from Vagabond who says, I booked my booster as soon as I heard the news this morning for my health and for those around me, just in time for my first Thanksgiving travel in 2 years. So with that tension you just described, what's the calculus about saying, yeah, everybody over 18 can get a booster? What's at play here?
I think basically the Biden administration is trying to prevent infections and not just hospitalizations and deaths. We were always hearing earlier on that the bar was really to prevent people from getting really sick. But now, because the case numbers are not going down, the Biden administration is betting that if everybody gets boosters, they can also contain the spread of the virus. There's just not a lot of evidence to say that that will happen, though. And some of that is just speculation. Some of that assumes that everybody who needs boosters will get them. Some of that assumes that the people who are most likely to spread the virus will get them. There are a lot of ifs for the strategy to work and not a lot of scientific evidence to back it.
Well, this is the second time the idea of COVID boosters for all has come before the FDA. Is part of what's at play the fact that some people have gone ahead and gotten boosters despite the guidance from the CDC and the FDA, and so there's just a lot of confusion at play?
I think that's definitely a big part of it. The messaging has been incredibly muddled. People aren't clear who should get it. Are they at risk? Should they get it so they don't get really sick? Should they get it to protect, you know, loved ones, older ones, people who are immunocompromised? There is just so much confusion about who needs it. And the one good thing about this boosters for all adults is that at least it simplifies the message. It says anybody who wants it, who's over 18, can go and get it. And that may actually at least simplify things for people somewhat. And we are, you know, heading toward the holidays, and people are going to be around, probably a lot of people who are vulnerable. So it may have some benefit in those terms for sure.
Now, David, some states have already been offering boosters to all adults, and people are already getting boosters regardless of whether they qualify. Why have boosters become so widespread despite a lack of that formal guidance from the FDA and the CDC?
Well, there's a huge universe of people who are frightened by this for a lot of reasons. They read the data. They see the symptoms. They want protection. I mean, it's why some people rush to get flu shots by September 1st and some don't. The other thing, remember, parents with young children who are not being vaccinated want the maximum protection. If you have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, you know, you want all you can get. So I think that's a big reason for this. One question I have, and maybe the other reporters, is there one controversy I hear is that, well, why give boosters to people under 65 when you can take these doses and use them abroad in poorer countries? And you hear that at the Capitol. I mean, it hasn't really bubbled up into an issue yet, but I'm curious if that's going to be more of an issue.
Yeah, Apoorva, this is something we hear a lot during our Vaccination Nation shows, people saying, why are we extending booster shots to people who have already had a full course of the vaccine when there are so many other developing nations that don't have access at all? What are you hearing about that?
You know, this is playing out at a couple of different levels. If you're an individual and you're worried, as David was saying, then it makes sense to walk into a CVS or go to your doctor and get a booster shot. And the U.S. government has bought up enough doses to offer boosters to all its citizens. But at a national level and an international level, it is a zero-sum game. There is only so much vaccine production capacity. There is only so much vaccine ingredients, so many factories that can make these things. And so when we give out boosters, when Europe gives out boosters, it does mean that there are fewer doses to go around for other parts of the world. And the big concern among a lot of experts is that we are leaving the door wide open for another variant to come up that may not even respond to the vaccines very well. So, you know, we are covering one base while leaving a lot of others open.
Well, this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci told the Reuters Total Health Conference the pandemic could become endemic by next year.
For me, endemicity means a lot of more people get vaccinated, a lot more people get boosted. And although you don't eliminate or eradicate, that infection is not dominating your life. That's what endemicity means to me.
And do we get there next year, in your view?
I think it's conceivable that we will. I mean, I hope we do. And it might even be likely if we implement a good vaccination of the unvaccinated and a really good uptake of boosting those who are fully vaccinated, because we can see that the data are right in front of us. Just look at what's going on in Israel. Look what other countries are doing now about adopting a booster campaign virtually for everybody. I think if we do that and we do it in earnest, I think by the spring we can have a pretty good control of this.
Now, Apoorva, Dr. Fauci there saying we could reduce current levels to an endemic state by next year. Just explain a little bit more about what it means for something to be endemic.
It means that everybody who needs to be protected has been, so that even if somebody gets infected, they don't get very sick. There's not a huge amount of pressure on the healthcare system. People are not flooding hospitals. It's sort of like you think about the flu or some other milder common cold coronaviruses. They're around. You may get a little bit sick. You may get sniffly, but you are not going to end up in the hospital. I'm not sure that Dr. Fauci's prediction of next spring is likely to happen, because it does need a lot of unvaccinated people to get vaccinated. And the bar for what it is to be vaccinated just got higher. We are now saying you need 3 doses for full protection. And that may actually discourage some people who are thinking about getting vaccinated from going down that road. It also means that everybody who needs boosting needs to get one, as he was saying. And so far, that hasn't really been the case. You know, we have something like 89% of the population, the adult population, is eligible once they added depression to the list of conditions that qualify you. And that's been the case for several weeks now. And yet, only 18% of American adults have gotten them. So some of that may change, you know, now that it'll be authorized for all adults very clearly and people will know it's for them. But we've seen over and over again that the people who really want them go out and get them right away. And then there's a very slow, slow tail where people make up their minds over a very long period of time. So I'm not sure that by spring we will have enough protection for everybody to get to endemicity.
And Apoorva, what is the vaccination rate right now in the U.S.? How many Americans have been fully vaccinated?
We have about 192 million doses that have been given out. We have 196 million, are fully vaccinated. And that's about 70% fully vaccinated. We have some kids who are vaccinated. So we are making progress, but it's been very slow. We were at 60% for much of the year, from the spring to the summer. And so it's some of that may change again as the numbers go up this fall and winter. If we see that the holidays bring up the number of cases, that may convince some people, because we've seen that fear is a big motivator, to go out and get the vaccines. And hopefully we'll make some progress there. Otherwise, a lot of people may also get infected and get immunity that way. So one way or the other, we may crawl towards having the number of people that we need to have protected in this country get there.
Jeff, what do we know about that roughly 20% of American adults who still aren't even partially vaccinated?
Look, a lot of them are younger adults whose jobs don't require it, who have some objection to this, simply aren't paying attention, simply don't believe that they will get sick because of this. And it's kind of an immovable number, some officials believe, which is why they are focusing more on the boosters, the people who have already agreed to get vaccinated or been required to get vaccinated by their jobs. But it's something that a number that is not likely to change all that much. But there has been so much just confusion and just mis messaging. So White House officials that I was have been talking with this week, they do hope that the simplicity to come, if the CDC approves this today, will be somewhat helpful to messaging here. Everyone needs a booster when it's their time, and get a booster. So that's what their hope is. And Dr. Fauci certainly has gone all in on that simple message, get a booster.
We're talking to CNN's Jeff Zeleny, David Lightman of McClatchy Newspapers, and Apoorva Mandavili of The New York Times. Apoorva, the U.S. is seeing an uptick in cases right now. The nation is averaging more than 83,000 cases a day, which is up 14% compared to a week ago and up 12% more than 2 weeks ago. As we approach the holidays, briefly, what should people keep in mind?
They should keep in mind that there might be people around them who are unvaccinated, who are vulnerable in some way. We've stopped taking a lot of the precautions that we were taking before and that we were taking last year. The cases are going up at almost exactly the same time as they were last fall, but with many, many fewer restrictions. We have schools open. We have restaurants open. Everybody's going to be traveling in record numbers, apparently, this holiday season. So I would say, again, the same things that we know how to do. Be masked indoors when you can be. You make sure that the people around you are vaccinated if you're going to be mask-free. Open windows when you can. Socialize outdoors when you can. You know, just do the little things that we know actually do make a big difference to transmission.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. Now, on Thursday, the U.S. government announced it had purchased more than $5 billion worth of Pfizer's COVID-19 pill. Apoorva, this is an experimental antiviral drug. What more can you tell us about it?
This is actually a really exciting development, and Pfizer's is the second one that's come out. Merck had a similar one come out a couple weeks ago. And basically, these antiviral drugs are the alternative to vaccines in a lot of the world where vaccines are not really available. You know, if somebody gets sick, if they take one of these pills within a few days of getting symptoms, in Pfizer's case, it's within 3 days of symptoms, if you take it, it cuts down the risk of hospitalization or death by 89%. Merck's is a little bit less effective. It's about 50% if you take it within 5 days of symptoms. But this is still a game changer for a lot of the world because, you know, for people who can't prevent getting infected, they can still really manage the symptoms and hopefully not end up, you know, dying from COVID. The only thing left to see really is whether we can make enough of these pills to really help the world. Pfizer has said that it will share its know-how, but we haven't really seen any agreements yet. Merck has actually released its information to something called the Medicines Patent Pool, which is an organization that makes treatments accessible to the world. And if that goes through as hoped, that, then these pills will be available in something like 105 countries. So we're really talking about a different phase of this pandemic with these pills.
David, how does this new drug fit into the Biden administration's overall strategy of getting COVID under control?
Very much so. This was his promise. Arguably, it's one of the reasons he was elected. Biden was elected on the idea that he was competent. He knows how to manage a government. He knows how to manage a crisis. There's been some stumbles in the public perception of this. But if you have this pill, again, this is a game changer, as we just said. So, yeah, it can help things a lot.
Well, before we go, the U.S. hits a grim milestone. More than 100,000 people died of an overdose between May 2020 and April 2021. That's up almost 30% from the year before. It's a record high for overdose deaths. Apoorva, why are we seeing this surge?
COVID is a big part of it. You know, I was hearing from ER doctors all through the year that COVID deaths would go up and down, but that they were seeing a steady high stream of overdose deaths coming through their doors. And also the availability of synthetic opioids, which are really easy to transport across borders. Fentanyl is responsible for 2/3 of the deaths that you just mentioned. And, you know, the U.S. government has apparently seized enough fentanyl this year to give every American a lethal dose. So we are talking about just massive amounts of this very dangerous substance that's now lacing every single drug that people take. And so I think there's just opportunity. There's the stress, the grief, the isolation and loneliness from COVID. There's just a lot of things in combination here.
Jeff, briefly, what are federal and local governments doing to try to stem the tide?
Well, one thing that they're doing is simply trying to shine a light on this as a true epidemic, that this is a true health crisis in the country. Part of this money we were talking about earlier from the social spending measures and other things are designed to curb this as well. So I think, you know, really shining the light on it, that it is something that should be talked about. It is something that should be addressed. It's doubled since 2015, which is just staggering and remarkable.
We've been talking to Jeff Zeleny, the chief national affairs correspondent with CNN, David Lightman, the congressional correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Apoorva Mundavilli. She covers science and global health for The New York Times. Thanks to you all. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from K. Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
For the next hour, we'll look at some of the biggest stories from overseas. It's been a week of heavy diplomacy for President Biden, who spent hours in talks with far-off foes and nearby neighbors. Life on board the International Space Station has returned to normal, but only after a couple of adrenaline-filled days following a Russian missile test that threw a cloud of space debris into the station's orbit. We also have an update from the chairman of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee on U.S. efforts to end the bloodshed in Tigray. There's a lot to get to, and here to guide us through it is Jennifer Williams. She's a deputy editor at Foreign Policy and host of the podcast, The Negotiators. Jen, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Rosalind Jordan. She's a State Department correspondent for Al Jazeera English Television. Roz, happy Friday.
And same to you. Glad to be back.
And David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, it's always a pleasure.
Hello.
So we'll start with a question that millions are asking. Where is Peng Shuai? In a more recent development, the head of the Women's Tennis Association has questioned the authenticity of an email he received purporting to be from the Chinese tennis player. Shuai hasn't been seen since she made sexual assault allegations against a former top Communist Party official 2 weeks ago. Now, David, we've seen reports here that the Chinese censors have been working overtime to bury this story. How successful have they been?
Well, you're right. They've been very successful, which is what they do. I mean, her first allegation was up for between about 20 and 30 minutes, and it was an explosive allegation that she had been raped and then had had a very coercive affair with a very senior Chinese communist leader, 40 years older than her, Zhang Gaoli, a former vice premier. And that was taken down, and you now cannot search her name on the Chinese internet. It's a complete kind of no-go zone. You cannot find any news about this in Chinese. And that is leaving the Chinese in a real trap, because they are being pounded now in English-language social media on Twitter by some of the world's most famous tennis stars and sports stars demanding to know where Peng Shuai is. And they can't respond easily because they haven't told the Chinese people that she's missing at all. And so you're seeing very bizarre things. One of the most powerful men in Chinese media, very powerful newspaper editor, kind of nationalist provocateur called Hu Xijin, went onto Twitter in English earlier today and said that the foreign media were getting this wrong. He said, "I do not believe that she received repression speculated by foreign media for the thing people talked about," because he can't say what's being talked about, because that's a secret in China. And so you see they're tied up in knots now. And this is why we saw this extraordinary email put out by the English language CGTN, which is the English language arm of Chinese state television, which purported to be an email written very stilted English from Peng Shuai, saying that she was absolutely fine, she's just resting, and that everything is great, and that she's very cross that they put out these allegations about her, and please leave her alone. But the problem was that it didn't read like a real email. There was also a cursor in the middle, which doesn't appear in an email, but does appear if you've just written a Word document and screenshotted it. So that made things 10 times worse, because it looks like the state TV is now trying to cover up in a very crude way the extraordinary disappearance of this former world number one doubles women's tennis champion.
Well, Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka are just two of the sport's best-known stars to voice their concerns over the well-being and whereabouts of the Chinese tennis player. And you can add to that list the man who ranks as number one in the world for the men's game, Novak Djokovic.
I did hear about it a week ago, and it's honestly, it's shocking, you know, that she's missing. I mean, more so that it's someone that I've seen on the tour in the previous years quite a few times. So, I mean, you know, I can imagine just how her family feels that she's missing.
And Steve Simon, the CEO of the Women's Tennis Association, has also cast doubt on a message sent to him that's purported to be from the player. In part, the message reads, "I am not missing, nor am I unsafe. I've just been resting at home and everything is fine." Here's part of Simon's statement. "I have a hard time believing that Peng Shuai actually wrote the email we received or believes what is being attributed to her. The WTA and the rest of the world need independent and verifiable proof that she is safe." Jen, talk a little bit more about what's happening here in terms of this tension between the WTA and China, because tennis is a huge sport there.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, I think the big kind of broader takeaway beyond the specifics of this particular case is that we're seeing, you know, specifically women's tennis really not kowtowing to China in the way that we have seen maybe, you know, the NBA and other, you know, even Hollywood and other, you know, American and U.S. And Western organizations who really have, you know, the bottom line is that they have a huge market in China. They want to make money in China, and they don't want to, you know, cross the Chinese Communist Party in any way to jeopardize that. And I think it's really remarkable to see how the WTA has come out, how individual stars have come out and are just openly, you know, criticizing China and calling for, you know, for some accountability on this. And I think it speaks to a lot of changes that we're seeing in sports, in particular in women's tennis, of course. You know, you have Naomi Osaka making that statement. She herself has made, you know, headlines recently for standing up for her own kind of emotional security. We've seen Ines Kanter of the NBA, you know, openly speaking up against China, against Turkey. So I think you're starting to see, you know, some of these organizations, and in particular some of the players, really starting to put, you know, human rights, human dignity, their own needs, you know, ahead of politics, ahead of the money, ahead of the bottom line. And I think it's, in general, you know, definitely a really good development, although I assume the Chinese Communist Party would beg to differ.
Well, following the statement from Steve Simon, Patrick McEnroe, a former U.S. Davis Cup captain, told CNN the amount of money the game makes in China might have persuaded some sports execs to dial down the language. But McEnroe says in this case, the stance taken by the WTA is to be applauded.
That, to me, is why this is even a bigger statement from Steve Simon, to take this stand. That's a morally correct stand to take. And when is it going to be enough is enough when it comes to what's going on with some of these issues that are happening in China? And they're just saying, oh, this isn't even a story to them. Well, it's a story for us and for the rest of the world.
David, flesh out how much of a risk the WTA is taking with this robust approach.
I mean, they clearly are going to, you know, have, if they keep this up, then we're not going to see the finals of the WTA tour in the southern city of Shenzhen. I mean, I think it's important to say this is a fantastically brave stance, but I think one of the explanations is that if you compare it to the kind of money that the NBA makes in China, tennis just isn't that big a sport here. It's very much a kind of the wealthiest, most urban Chinese play tennis. People are happy when Chinese tennis players like Peng Shuai win things, but it's nowhere near as big as soccer or basketball. So, you know, I think if you're the WTA, they're doing something impressive. But the truth is that if they have to choose between feminism and women's rights and this kind of interesting potential future market in China, being on the side of women, clearly if you're the Women's Tennis Association, is massively more important. So I think that helps to explain this judgment. I think we need to kind of pull the lens back and realize that this is part of also a much bigger story in China about the Chinese Communist Party being extremely uncomfortable with feminism and the Me Too movement, which has been sort of bubbling away here. And we've seen very brave young Chinese women accusing famous state TV presenters, famous academics at elite universities. And in most of those cases, the men have crushed their younger women accusers, because the Chinese Communist Party, although it says that it stands for, you know, equality between the sexes, what it really stands for is order and discipline and the existing hierarchies being maintained. And so these young women have been crushed in some cases without mercy because they have dared to challenge. And of course, this is what's so dangerous about Peng Shuai. Is she's accusing a very senior communist leader, 40 years older than her, of having raped her and had this very abusive relationship. And that doesn't fit the Communist Party's story at the moment, that it is an incredibly benevolent party that has brought the best government ever to China. And so We don't know where she is, but it's a very frightening situation. And she is not, unfortunately, anywhere near the only young woman to end up in real trouble for raising her voice.
David, when you talk about these young women being crushed by the Chinese Communist Party and their accusers, explain exactly what that means.
So it takes different forms. So we saw a very famous case of a young woman who worked as a producer for state TV who accused a very famous kind of star TV variety show host. He ended up suing her for defamation and winning, even though she seemed to have a lot of evidence. And, you know, we've seen famous professors being accused by students. And again, the university has sided with the professors. And those students have either been kind of thrown out of the university or their families have been threatened. We've seen people, you know, at much lower levels, if you threaten your boss, then you lose your job or your family is told that they're going to lose their jobs. There's a kind of real sense that this is not acceptable. On university campuses over the last 2 or 3 years, we have seen Me Too movements starting and they have been crushed because any student movement that isn't organized and approved of by the party is crushed to the point that you can't even put the phrase Me Too on Chinese social media. It's censored immediately. And one of the kind of really interesting things about the Chinese sort of opposition sort of activists is they're so smart, they try and do these things. So the Chinese for rice rabbit is Me Too. And so people have started saying they support rice rabbits on the internet. And then the censors caught up with that. But you see, people are playing games to try and get around the censorship. But the truth is that the party believes in order and discipline and the existing hierarchy. And they are very conservative people, despite being communists.
Rosalind, what does this mean for Shuai?
If everything that David says is true, it does not look good. And given that outsiders can't just go into China and go to her house to see where she is, there's a lot of worry.
How much do we know about the more than 3-hour video call between Chinese President Xi Jinping and his American counterpart Joe Biden? Well, after months of tension, the virtual meeting was supposed to ease those tensions and global fears of a confrontation between China and the U.S. David, in your latest column for The Economist, you use a weather metaphor to describe the relationship between these two. Explain more.
Well, the metaphor was because it was a nice, sunny, sort of early winter day for the day of the call. And it's important that the call took place, that the relationship has got so bad that really these were the only two men who could have a substantive conversation because the Chinese side has been refusing to really engage on a serious way on policy questions. Even when the Americans wanted to do things like discuss joint action on climate change, you had Chinese officials saying, well, until you stop criticizing us on things like human rights in Xinjiang, why should we talk to you about cooperative things like climate change? And so things have got really deadlocked. And Joe Biden, who has known Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, for a long time, when they were both vice presidents, they spent quite a long time together. These two men could at least have a substantive conversation. So it is good news that it happened. But the metaphor I use is that, unfortunately, in Beijing, after a nice sunny day like that, we're due in for a very cold winter. And I think that's also true of U.S.-China relations, because this nearly three and a half hour call, ended without any substantive agreements. They agreed on one thing, which is that these two countries are too powerful and too important to just drift into an accidental conflict. And so they do need to manage their differences. So they agreed to manage their differences. But deals, substantive kind of policy agreements, there was none of that. And expectations were super low. And things remained really very bad on a whole range of subjects.
Roz, as a seasoned State Department reporter, is there one issue more than most that's keeping officials awake at night about what's next with China?
It's really hard to say that there is just one issue. If you go back to the first years of the Obama administration, there was this famous rebalancing of U.S. Military assets to the Indo-Pacific. And that was because there was real concern then about China's efforts to control free passage of the high seas, something that every country has a right to do under international law. There was real concern about how China would deal with Hong Kong, which was technically returned to its control. And we, of course, have seen the efforts to basically make Hong Kong more Chinese, restricting freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of government behavior. We've seen the rise in tension over the independence, and I use that word in air quotes because Beijing probably wouldn't like it to be without them, the independence of Taiwan. And we've seen growing harsh rhetoric coming from the Biden administration about its friendship with the leadership and with the people of Taiwan. There's a whole range of issues that has the United States very concerned about China's growing influence around the world. And the U.S. Says that it is looking at Beijing not as a partner, but through a much more negative prism, a very pragmatic and very transactional type of relationship. And I think that was sort of the context or the atmosphere of the leaders' summits between Presidents Biden and Xi earlier this week.
Now, Jen, President Biden has not ruled out some kind of boycott of the Winter Games in China that's just a few months away in February. We know some in his party think that would be the right thing to do. How is that issue complicating an already complicated relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that is in the public conversation right now. You know, this is not necessarily a new idea, right? We have seen boycotts of the Olympics by the U.S. and then, you know, by the Soviet Union sort of in retaliation back during the Cold War. There is a lot of concern, I think, among athletes in particular, you know, who would say, you know, okay, maybe you can do a diplomatic boycott, meaning the U.S. doesn't send officials there, but could you please make sure you still let the athletes go, right? Because for a lot of these athletes, this may be their one and only shot at winning a medal at the Olympics. And so there's, you know, definite concern there. There's also a lot of concerns just more generally around, you know, trying to not ratchet up tensions, especially given how tense things are, in particular over Taiwan right now. And so, you know, they have to balance that. The Biden administration has to balance that against also standing up for human rights and making sure that they are promoting, you know, the values that they say that their administration stands for. So it's definitely a really complicated kind of calculation there. And I think it's understandable that we're seeing them maybe not come out and say something right away, right after this summit. It's also the fact that right after this summit, Biden made a bit of a gaffe, you know, mentioning he was asked about the summit during a press conference on something else. And he said, you know, we've made very clear we support the Taiwan Act and that's it. It's independent. They immediately had to walk that back and say, no, that's not what we meant. We just meant that they do their own thing. Oh, God, sorry, we said independence. That's the one word you really don't want to say when you're talking about Taiwan and you're Joe Biden. And, you know, the Chinese immediately were not thrilled about that. And so, you know, I think given that that had just happened right after the summit, I think it's understandable that it want to go, by the way, we're also boycotting the Olympics. Sorry, everyone. So I do think we may see a decision. I know there's, you know, a move in Congress, you know, people pushing for that. But I think, you know, at most, I think we would see a diplomatic boycott, like I said, with just U.S. officials not officially going in, you know, in their capacity, but the U.S. still probably participating in the games themselves.
David, how closely is the rest of the world watching this relationship and how it plays out moving forward?
It is the most important bilateral relationship in the world. I mean, if you're in Asia, the whole American kind of post-1945 structure where they have troops in Korea, troops in Japan, you know, American warships keeping the peace in the Pacific, enforcing those sea lanes that Rosalind talked about. That is all sort of predicated on America being able to stick around right up to kind of China's shores. And the real fear, certainly in that bit of Asia, is that the Chinese plan is to become so strong and so aggressive that they can take Taiwan and push the Americans back to kind of Guam or ideally Hawaii and have one shore of the Pacific dominated completely by China, and then leave America to look after California and the west coast of the United States, but not come over to China's side of the ocean. And that vision would be a complete change and a very unwelcome change for a whole bunch of countries in Asia that do not want to be left alone with an increasingly aggressive and assertive China. Every other, you know, countries that we didn't used to think about being involved in these fights, Australia, remember, has just signed a deal with the UK and the US to buy these nuclear submarines that in part are about patrolling in the deep ocean near Taiwan, which is basically Australia putting its hand up and saying, we are willing to be alongside America as one of the powers deterring a Chinese attack on Taiwan. And that, I think, is because so many Western countries, though they would hate the idea, they dread the idea, which they should, of anything like a war with China, they also dread the idea of the entire 1945 kind of post-World War II American-led Western order collapsing and being replaced by China. And so I think all eyes are on this relationship, and there was relief that the two men talked, but no real confidence that they've actually worked out how to coexist in a sustainable way, because the fundamental problems are just too big right now to find an easy solution to any of them.
So big fundamental problems, Roz, but also places where it would require the U.S. and China to work together for us to see serious movement around things like, you know, the COP26 climate deal, vaccinating the world to end the pandemic, the Iran nuclear talks, a place where the U.S. and China is facing important tests. Break down that tension a little bit more for us.
Well, that's the pragmatic, transactional part of the relationship, which President Joe Biden has repeatedly talked about and which Secretary of State Antony Blinken has repeatedly talked about. When it comes to climate change, people may not have paid as much attention to this, but just as the conference was ending in Glasgow, Blinken and his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Yi, announced that they had reached a deal on bilateral efforts to try to reduce greenhouse gases and to work on transition from fossil fuels to clean energy, and were in pledging, you know, and setting timelines for how they were going to work together, since these two countries do produce an outsized amount of the world's pollution. When it comes to the Iran nuclear deal, people forget China does hold one of the permanent five seats on the UN Security Council. It is a party to the JCPOA. It has a vested interest in not seeing another nuclear power in the Middle East, and it very much wants to see these discussions resume to try to bring Tehran back into compliance with the terms of the 2015 deal. And certainly when it comes to matters such as trying to deal with trade, even though there was no breakthrough announced this week in the meeting between Biden and Xi, there is a better understanding of the challenges that both countries are facing, given that we're still dealing with the pandemic, given that that is having a direct impact on economic activity in both countries. And so trying to find a way to protect people's health, even as there is still this unresolved question about how COVID-19 actually originated and then went out into the world, the larger question is keeping people alive and healthy. And so the U.S. and China are going to try to find ways to engage on those issues without trying to let things worsen any more than perhaps they already have.
I want to move on to other news in a moment. But first, David, how is this relationship playing out from China's view? We can hear the reports here in the U.S., but what are the optics like where you are?
It was interesting. So we've had a very hostile kind of propaganda take on America, really for the duration of, for example, COVID. So the story here in China, which is told to the Chinese people, is that they're very lucky to live in a safe place, China, which has eliminated the virus within its own borders by basically sealing those borders and constantly locking down cities where there are a small number of cases. That is then buttressed with images of, you know, anti-vax protests in the West, of body bags and overwhelmed hospitals. A lot of Chinese, where I am, still think that basically the American COVID outbreak is complete chaos. There's kind of death and destruction and chaos and body bags everywhere. The idea that parts of the West are now returning to something closer to normality is not well known here. And as a foreigner, one of the very few foreigners now around, because so many people have left and can't come in and out, you know, they will always say to me, oh, you're British, you know, your country is completely messed up COVID like the Americans. You know, what's wrong with you people? So there is a real message being pushed that America is in decline, that America is decadent, that America is tired and old and selfish, and that Joe Biden is kind of tired and old. And so, you know, state censorship is incredibly strict on Chinese social media, but they have been allowing people to mock Joe Biden as the Shui Wang, the sleepy king, with images of him sort of falling asleep and having naps and meetings. What was interesting this week, though, was that they suddenly turned a bit more respectful, a bit more conventional. But they pushed very hard the idea that this was the Americans and the Chinese coming together as equals. And on state television, the evening news, we had images of Joe Biden. They chose of him writing notes just after Xi Jinping had spoken. So the idea was that Xi Jinping is the more powerful, more impressive leader, and that Joe Biden was obediently taking notes. So that's the kind of image. The long-term image is that China is rising. and that the West is in decline. And that began, you know, very much with Trump. And the idea of Joe Biden, I'm afraid here that you hear from Chinese officials, is that Joe Biden is just a transition figure, that he's weak, that he's old, that he doesn't have control of his own Congress, that he's going to lose the next elections, and he might well not be president for more than one term. And so why waste much time trying to do deals with him? So there is, behind the kind of the nice optics of this video call, a real sense of pretty open disdain for the United States.
Well, let's move on to other diplomatic work the president did this week. President Biden hosted Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador at the White House yesterday. The summit comes after a five-year hiatus during the Trump administration, and immigration is a top concern. Jen, what do these three nations want from each other when it comes to immigration and asylum?
Yeah, in particular, you know, the immigration and asylum issue between the U.S. and Mexico is one of the huge, you know, obviously glaring issues that they needed to address. And it was really interesting because they didn't actually, you know, come out and say that they were going to address one of the most pressing issues, which is the controversial Remain in Mexico policy. They actually said, you know, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said that because of pending litigation over that policy, that it would prevent that policy from being openly discussed, but did say that migration, you know, in general would be discussed. It was really odd, though. I mean, throughout the entire meeting, when they had these kind of press availabilities, they would very much, all three leaders would very much shy away from discussing anything about immigration. And I think, you know, that's important to understand. The point of this meeting in the public sense was very much to kind of show this united front that, you know, the three amigos, as they're calling themselves, these three leaders, that, you know, we have it together. We, you know, we're not in chaos. Our relationship is fine. Things are going fine. And then behind closed doors, there were much, you know, more serious issues like immigration, like trade, right? We have a lot of the kind of legacy of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement that hasn't quite been implemented. There are a lot of frustrations on all sides about, you know, different ways, you know, with electric vehicles between the U.S. and Canada, and labor rights issues between the U.S. and Mexico. There are all these kind of outstanding things with that deal that they really needed to work out. But in public, you just kept seeing this very kind of united front they were trying to present. And I think it was very fascinating. They kept just declining to answer these questions. They said that they would, you know, they were going to discuss humane ways to address the root causes that drive people north for immigration. But they just kept refusing to discuss these main policies that are the big flashpoints. And that, you know, in particular, immigration activists were pushing very hard for them to address publicly.
On Wednesday, the Federal Aviation Administration warned pilots that planes operating out of Ethiopia's main international airport could soon come under fire. The FAA said aircraft could, quote, directly or indirectly be exposed to ground weapons fire and or surface-to-air fire, unquote. That's as the country's spiraling conflict nears the capital, Addis Ababa. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is in Africa as we speak. Today, he announced President Biden will host a U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit to ramp up relations between African countries and the U.S. On Thursday, Blinken spoke to the BBC about the conflict in Tigray, and he was asked if a diplomatic solution is still possible.
We are working overtime in support of the efforts of the African Union's lead mediator, former Nigerian President Obasanjo, to get a ceasefire, to get humanitarian assistance flowing. I think there is hope that the parties can sit down together, reach a ceasefire, make sure that humanitarian assistance is flowing, and, as I said, negotiate the concerns that they have for a durable political solution.
Before we came on air, I spoke to the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey. Congress has recently restricted trade privileges extended to Ethiopia, and I asked him what difference, if any, they'd make.
Well, these are very recent. The president issued an executive order on September 17th that provided a framework for sanctions on those who undermine peace and security in Ethiopia and sanctioned Eritrean entities last week and gave notice to Ethiopia that as of January 1st, it would no longer be eligible for the trade benefits under the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. So this is all coming together at this moment. It is my hope that it will move the parties to understand that this is not a conflict that has a military end, but one that needs to be dealt with through negotiation and a countrywide engagement.
How have the country's leaders responded to that move from the Biden administration?
Well, we have yet to see it ultimately lead to a change of course. But of course, these are relatively nascent actions that are taken. I'm very happy to see Secretary of State Blinken in Africa engaged with the issue of Ethiopia as a primary element of his visit to the continent. I think it's incredibly important to organize, support, and multilateralize our efforts to try to bring an end to the tragedy that is happening in Ethiopia.
Well, you first called on both sides in this conflict to de-escalate more than a year ago. The situation has only gotten worse since. Realistically, how much leverage does the U.S. really have in the region?
It's a challenge when we go to the UN Security Council to multilateralize our efforts as it relates both to the Ethiopian government, as it relates to the Eritreans, and China and Russia ultimately will not allow us to move forward with the type of actions that the United Nations could impose to change the dynamics and stop the loss of life.
You said it's important to impress upon the authorities in Ethiopia that this conflict doesn't have a military end. But can you see any scenario that demands that the U.S. or an international coalition will need to actively intervene on the ground to prevent this from further spiraling out of control?
I think the only way in which that happens is if there is an African Union initiative or a United Nations initiative to do so. But what we are witnessing in Tigray, what we are seeing is undeniably similar to what we saw in Darfur. And the world should not be willing to allow this to continue, ignore it, and turn a blind eye.
Well, we should note one former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia has called this situation Rwanda-esque. It's also been noted that the Biden administration has stopped short of calling what's going on a genocide. Senator, you're the chairman of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. You know words matter. Do you believe a genocide is underway in the region?
Yes, and I have said so. And as we see a genocide unfolding, we need to do everything we can to stop it, and we need to call it as such. If the phrase that we use never again is to have any meaning, when a genocide is being committed, it needs to be recognized as such in the moment, not for history, in the moment, and then there need to be actions that seek to stop the genocide from continuing to take place.
An investigation by the UN and Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission found that both sides in this conflict have committed, quote, violations of international human rights, humanitarian and refugee law, some of which may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. What does accountability look like in this case, whether it's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed or it's people on the other side of the conflict?
Well, there are no white knights or angels in this conflict. It seems to me that all parties have been destructive. What is clear that a political contest has become a deadly armed conflict that has cost the lives of too many. And so the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights released a report that found that war crimes and crimes against humanity may have been committed by all parties to the conflict. And so it seems to me that those who participated in war crimes need to be tried for it.
That's my conversation with Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's a Democrat from New Jersey. I'd like to hear your reactions to what we just heard there. Rosalind?
I think the senator was being extremely diplomatic. The situation in Ethiopia is very much at a tipping point, and pardon me for using the cliche. The special envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, is in Addis Ababa as we speak, alongside, as the senator mentioned, Olusegun Obasanjo, the former Nigerian president and now the special representative for the AU for the Horn of Africa. They are basically engaged in marathon negotiations with all parties, both the office of President Abiy Ahmed and the leaders of the Tigrayan rebels, who have been engaged in some pretty bloody fighting with government forces over the past year or so. There is critical attacks are critical attacks, I should say, on UN workers who happen to be Tigrayan by the central government. So that means food and medicine are not getting into Tigray. That means that there are reports of rape being used as a weapon of war on both sides. There is a real concern, according to the World Food Program and to other UN agencies, that women and children are suffering acute malnutrition. This is, of course, happening in a country that has long had challenges keeping people fed and healthy. And there are, you know, very real concerns that there is looming political instability, and perhaps we're on the verge of a civil war. Feltman and Obasanjo are trying to prevent that from happening. But this is a conflict that is now more than a year old. President Abiy sees some political advantage from his own forces and his own political base to not give in to Tigrayan demands. But he's also being accused of carrying out targeted harassment and kidnapping and detention, and in some cases murders, of Tigrayans who are opposed to central government leadership. So this is a very, very precarious situation.
Jen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think what struck me the most is, to hear Senator Menendez, reference Darfur specifically. And as you, very wisely also mentioned that, other people have called it Rwanda-esque. Senator Menendez has been on the Foreign Relations Committee. He is very knowledgeable on foreign affairs. And for him to use that reference specifically to Darfur, I think really just reveals how stark this conflict has become and how deeply, deeply concerned everyone, all observers are, that this is going to get so much worse. And I think even, hearing Blinken, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, just today warning that, the war has put Ethiopia on a, quote, path to destruction. I think, as much as there is hope that these diplomatic efforts will lead to some sort of peace talks, I think there is increasingly, we're increasingly seeing a lot of officials sounding the alarm that maybe that's not going to happen, and that if it doesn't, we are facing potentially really, really dire situation in Addis Ababa and the broader region.
David, anything to add?
I think so. I mean, look, words are important, but they're only, you cannot impose peace on a country where the two warring parties don't want peace as much as they want to win. And I think that was the message from the Secretary of State to the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, that he's not going to win, that there isn't a military solution, that in fact his country could blow up on him. Remember, he started this war to crush his rivals, his enemies in the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. The problem is that Abiy Ahmed is not ready to give up that fight, and the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front think they have a chance of winning. They're heading down towards the capital, Addis Ababa. And so you see that words are great. Senators saying, we should use this word or that word, that's fine. But if the people on the ground don't want peace, they want to keep fighting because they think that's in their interests, it's very difficult to impose peace from the outside.
Well, let's move on to another story this week from space. This week, the U.S. accused Russia of endangering astronauts aboard the International Space Station. That's after a Russian missile test caused a satellite explosion. Astronauts aboard the ISS were forced to take emergency shelter to avoid the debris. The crew of seven includes two Russians. In a statement, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson called the test irresponsible and destabilizing. And here's State Department spokesperson Ned Price speaking on the issue earlier this week.
The test has so far generated over 1,500 pieces of trackable orbital debris and hundreds of thousands of pieces of smaller orbital debris that now threaten the interests of all nations. In addition, this test will significantly increase the risk to astronauts and cosmonauts on the International Space Station, as well as to other human spaceflight activities. Russia's dangerous and irresponsible behavior jeopardizes the long-term sustainability of our outer space and clearly demonstrates that Russia's claims of opposing the weaponization of space are disingenuous and hypocritical.
Rosalind, what happened here?
Well, the Russians were testing their ability to clear orbit, of a satellite they didn't need anymore. But not only did they decide to do this, they didn't really tell anyone beforehand they were going to do this, which is, you know, your first breach of etiquette. But more seriously, they also said that what they were doing was necessary and did not show that they were doing what the U.S. and China and other countries and organizations, including NATO, have accused Russia of trying to militarize space. So that is really at the heart of everyone's outrage over this incident. Now, that's not to say that other countries haven't tried in their own ways to deal with the growing amount of traffic in orbit around the Earth, but there is this concern, particularly now when the U.S. and the European Space Agency are trying new ways of getting into space, and there's a growing debate about whether space should be used for commercial purposes, to now have this introduction or reintroduction, as some would argue, of the militaristic component that has people very much concerned, because those issues have not been fully debated. There have not been agreements between countries on refusing to militarize space once and for all. And so that's really where this alarm came from.
David, how has Russia responded to the controversy?
Well, Russia, as usual, says that this is American hypocrisy, that it's America that has been filling space with advanced space weapons, that the Russian satellite test was anti-satellite test was carried out with surgical precision. The big picture here is that space is already militarized. I mean, if you think about the vital importance of GPS satellite navigation for every weapon system, it's not just every kind of plane and ship that has them. Every soldier now has GPS on them. Everything depends on communications from space, space spy satellites, navigation satellites. And the thing that is really energizing the space race is that the Americans are installing some very sophisticated space-based anti-satellite tracking satellites to try and get missile defenses of the next generation. And China, Russia, the Americans, to some extent the Indians, they are all testing what they can do in space. And part of that is the idea that you could, during a war, blind and leave defenseless your enemy by taking out their satellites. So this idea that we're shocked about the idea of militarizing space is pure hypocrisy on everyone's part, because space is already being militarized at an extremely rapid rate.
Jen, we've just got about 30 seconds here, and I just want to quickly touch on the border crisis in Belarus. Recently, the main camps at the border have been cleared by Belarusian authorities. Do we know what will happen to the migrants who were trapped there?
Yeah, so it seems that a lot of them have been moved to a nearby warehouse, and according to the border guards, they have been given, you know, blankets and hot meals. There was also a group on Thursday of about over 400 Iraqis who were repatriated from Belarus on a flight to Erbil that was arranged by the Iraqi government. So it looks like the conflict, the crisis is starting to wane, and hopefully things will get better soon.
Well, our thanks to Jen Williams, the deputy editor at Foreign Policy and host of the podcast, The Negotiators. Also with us, Rosalind Jordan, State Department correspondent for Al Jazeera English TV, and David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, Rosalind, Jen, thanks again. 1A's week of listener picks is coming up, and we'd love your help with this annual tradition of ours. Every January, we take your pitches and we turn them into a week's worth of shows. So you suggest a topic, 1A listeners across the country vote on which topics they want to hear, and then we produce them and bring them to you. So if you have a pitch for us, or an idea that's been rolling around in your brain, or just something you'd like to hear more about on our airwaves, leave a comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. We'll collect your pitches through November, put them to a vote in December, and in January, you'll hear them on the air. 1A's audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. Barb Anguiano looks after the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and conversations. 1A's senior producer is Jonquilin Hill, and our managing producer is Paige Osborne. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we will talk again on Monday. This is 1A.